This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Do you remember your sex education? Was it helpful to you? Was it filled with scientific information rather than real, practical advice? I'm Diggory Waite, and this is The Real Sex Education. Each week, I'll be joined by a guest. We'll impart our own sex wisdom, ask our own sex questions, and we'll go over all the things they don't teach you in school. To bring this all together, though, we'll need an expert. A sexpert, if you will. But the only sex and relationship therapist I know is my mum. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Diggs.
In this episode, we speak to Bethany Black.
I talk a lot about sex on stage because so many people are so squeamish about it and so embarrassed about it.
She tells us about coming out as trans.
The social worker went, oh, is that all? And I was like, and it was just like a weight lifted off my chest.
Discovering her sexuality.
I don't find the thought of sleeping with men absolutely repulsive, so therefore I must be bi.
And the ulterior motive of her school sex education.
Almost all of it was about how you don't have to smoke.
Hello and welcome to The Real Sex Education. I'm Diggory Waite and I'm joined as ever by accredited sex and relationship therapist Kate Campbell. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Diggs.
Every week, Mum and I give sex and relationships a good going over with a guest, and this week we're joined by a woman often described as Britain's only goth, lesbian, transsexual comedian. It's Bethany Black. We have a great chat with Bethany coming up where we discuss her life, her sex education and a whole lot more. So stay tuned for that. But Mum.
Yes.
We've done this podcast thing for a while now, and suddenly I just thought, like, what is the process of sex therapy or relationship therapy? Like, how? Let's say I'm a person or I'm a couple. How do I recognise that I might benefit from sex therapy or relationship therapy? And then from there, how do I get it? And then what are my first few sessions like?
Well, I suppose something's worrying you is the answer. And you can Google relationship therapists and sex therapists. They're not the same thing, actually. Some people are just relationship therapists or just sex therapists, and some people are both, like me. Some sex therapists are listed on the College of Sexual and Relationship Therapists website, or they might be on the British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy, where you'll also find some sex and relationship therapists. Counselling Directory, you know, just Google them as well. And there are other places. So that's how you'd find one.
And what about the first session?
So the first session, if it was sex therapy, for instance, you would be talking about what's going on for them and then talking about what you might do next, whether relationship therapy would be best or sex therapy or one and then the other, whatever. Mm. So after that first session, let's assume it's sex therapy, then people have, if they come to me, for instance, there would be quite a long history taking. And the history taking is part of the treatment, which can be very useful for people because it's an opportunity to put to bed some unhelpful ideas, to give some education about some things, to just talk about how you're feeling. That can be enough for some people. Mm. After that, though, they go on to have a meeting with the therapist about what the therapist has discovered and what their goals for the treatment would be. And then they would start straight into the so-called treatment. Which will be entirely designed for that couple or individual.
And dependent on what their
issue is, yes. But it always involves a sex ban, always.
Oh.
And if it's the kind of sex therapy I do, it will involve touching exercises, some talking ones, behavioural ones, some body ones, all sorts of things that they do together and separately. And then they'll come back, feedback on their exercises and be set some more. And everything is experimental. So there's nothing scary about it. It's that the emphasis is taken away from outcome and towards learning so that everything is seen as an experiment and therefore they can't get it wrong.
It's just, how did you feel about it? How did it go?
Yeah, how did it go?
Yeah.
And in the early stages, then, of course, as we've heard in earlier episodes, they won't be talking to one another about how they're finding the exercises. That will be banned. So each partner doesn't know what the other one's thinking to begin with, which is really helpful because too often they're trying to second guess the other one and trying to please the other one. And the emphasis at the beginning absolutely has to be on pleasing yourself. And more importantly, managing to take care of your feelings when you don't know what the other person's thinking, which is really difficult.
Yeah. And really, really interesting. But bottom line is, if you think you've got a problem, look it up. Look up some therapists. Mum gave some great examples there, which will pop in the show notes as well.
Yeah, there is some NHS availability and some agencies that offer sex and relationship therapy as well.
Great. Well, we'll get a little taster of some more of that therapeutic knowledge later in the show when I put a couple of conundrums to Kate that listeners have sent in via podcasts@hattrick.com or using the hashtag RealSexEDU. But before that, we spoke to comedian Bethany Black and we began, as always, by asking her what her sex education was like.
Awful.
Yeah.
Like, awful, terrible. I mean, my parents, for start, like, tried to be as progressive as they could be, really, and sort of considering the era and stuff like that. But there were even sort of like little bits of their own hang-ups that got imparted through that. I remember just an offhanded comment by my mum when I was little that women don't like having their boobs touched. And I was like, oh, right, okay. And I just took that as gospel. And then later realised, no, that is absolutely the exact opposite of... Oh, okay. And my school sex education was pretty appalling as well. Like, it was just so embarrassing and basic. Like, there was very little to it. It was one of those lessons that was just left to whoever it was, whoever was, like, was free on that particular afternoon. It was like whatever was left out, and they'd have to come in and they'd show us these videos for relationship type situations. And none of that was of any use either.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, actually, do you know what? I've just realised in thinking about it, almost all of it was about how you don't have to smoke.
What?
They're trying to fit two in one in there, aren't they?
You don't have to smoke in order to attract people of the opposite sex, because that was what it was all about. It was, you know, it was the early to mid 90s, so it was incredibly sort of like heterosexual, because obviously it had to be with the law. And the only thing, because I've been thinking about this a bit over the last couple of days, the only two things that I can really remember about our sex education at school was in one of the science lessons and one of the kids asking a substitute science teacher whether pubes can be different colours than black. And that's literally about the only thing that I really properly remember from my sex education at school was one of the teachers going, that's a very good question. Yes, they can.
Wow. So from then to now, do you think you were any wiser? How's your sex education? Did you get it from anywhere else?
Yeah, I mean, I got loads of sex education after school and outside of it from various different places, and just through, like, growing up and learning who I am and realising who I am, you know, being trans and being gay and slowly having to try and figure out exactly what these two things meant to me and navigating the shame of those in order to sort of go, well, this is who I am and I've just got to accept myself, and working through that and coming to terms with that and then being able to talk about those things on stage and then having people come up to me afterwards going, don't think about what other people say, just accept yourself. I'm like, well, I have. That's how I was able to talk about this stuff, but it's clear that you don't.
But I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, the reason we always talk about sex education, I suppose that, you know, for a lot of people, they have that base layer to go off. I mean, even though everyone comes on this podcast and says that is a shit base layer, you know, everyone comes on and says they had a shit sex education. But like you said, for a lot of people, it's very heteronormative. For a lot of people, they're cisgendered and straight. So at least they always have something to fall back on. So you have a very unique perspective in that you did it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it is interesting to hear about how you navigated that.
Yeah, because I think just so much of it, in terms of what we're taught, as, or at least were taught as sex education, it was essentially how not to get pregnant.
And how not to smoke, in your case.
Yeah,
well.
exactly. The two things are combined because, you know, if you can stop them from smoking, what are they going to do after they've had sex? Think about it. They're not going to do it again. Because so much of it was just about, you know, not getting pregnant. And if you're not sort of like standard issue human, you know, if you're not the default, almost everything that you've got to learn, you can kind of either play it off that, or you've also got so much stuff that comes from myth and schoolyard myths. And that not talking about it is the thing which goes and drives so many of those, not normalising it. When I came out as trans, my brother was freaked out, partly because my parents had moved to a little tiny village when he was about 6 or 7 years old. And it's the sort of little tiny village where he was considered an outsider. And even though I was born like 9 months after my parents moved there and 9 months after their anniversary, so I can't possibly think what the connection is of me suddenly being born 7 years after... my siblings. But all he ever really wanted to do was to try and fit in with the people in the village that we lived in. Like, he really is sort of like the white sheep of our family, you know. The rest of us are all a bit odd and a bit eccentric and a bit strange, and he just found all of that hugely embarrassing. And so when I came out as trans and his kids knew, he got very angry and was like, you know, they'll grow up and they'll be fucked up. And I was like, well, you know, you made the decision to raise them Catholic, so the damage is done there, to be, as far as I can tell. But the thing is, kids find everything strange and weird. The whole world's strange and weird to them. So if you just go and start normalising things that adults find a bit strange and weird, and you go, well, no, actually, this is a thing, that some people are like this, and not everybody will, you know, be straight and cisgender, and, you know, and there's all this different variance in human behaviour and in who people are, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, as long as no one's hurting anybody else, etc., etc. But his reaction to that was just, he was just, like, struggled with that so much. And, you know, what I quite like is that my nephew, who is now in his late 20s, does the sex education teaching at his school and deals with the LGBT sort of inclusivity, which is really, really lovely. It's a really lovely thing to have to sort of go.
Oh, wow.
Has it sort of come full circle? That's really sweet.
Yeah, it has. And my brother afterward, like initially, I mean, the way that I've painted it out there, it makes him sound really awful, but he isn't. He is such a staunch ally now, and it was just such an alien thing for him to have to try and cope with in 1999.
And I think it's understandable in some ways. I mean, I think some people paint people as terrible allies if they aren't on board with these things straight away. But I think it is initially shocking. I mean, you know, you're taught to think, I suppose, or you're told to think that gender doesn't matter and you should be on board straight away. Well, if gender didn't matter, then we wouldn't have people wanting to change their sex and their gender. Yeah. And let's say, you know, when it's a family member, you know, you've painted that person in a certain way. It's a sister, it's a brother, it's a dad, it's a mum. You know, they're all gendered things. So it is a bit of a shock initially when they're changing. That's why if we're being adult about it, I think you're allowed to give someone some time to come around to it. That's not excusing them being horrible in any way or putting anyone down, but initially it can be shocking.
Yeah, it is. And when I came out, I mean, I was aware before I came out, and I spent so much time living with shame around it and fear that I'd reached the point where I was about to, I was in such a dark and depressed place that I was unlikely to have survived for much longer if I hadn't have come out. This shows you like sort of how ridiculous my brain was working at the time. I was thinking, oh, maybe if I could get some antidepressants, I wouldn't feel quite so bad. So I'm going to have to go and try and pretend to the doctor that I'm depressed, which I was clearly like absolutely broken. I was disassociating at the time. I was in such a horrific state for just having tried to fulfill the life that I thought I had to. Otherwise, I would lose everyone and everything in it that I would love. And went to the doctor and tried to sort of make out that I was depressed, thinking, I'm going to make out that I'm depressed, not realising quite how depressed I was and quite how obvious it was that I was not just having suicidal ideation, but very, very close to
suicidal.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely suicidal. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. So she immediately prescribed me antidepressants and I was like, yes, I've tricked her.
I'm a good actor.
Yeah, exactly. That was it. I was like, yeah. Wow, I can't believe I managed to trick her into getting me these. This is brilliant. Yeah. And then about a week later, can't have been more than 48 hours later, I got a letter telling me that a social worker and a psychiatrist were going to come round to the house to visit me. And I was like, oh, wow, I thought there was going to be a much longer waiting list for this sort of thing. This is great. And then about a couple of days after that, went, oh, right, okay, they come round to your house, they're going to have to section you. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I remember being sat there in the lounge of that house, just staring at the ground and them asking me if there was anything that I could tell them as to why I felt as awful as I did and was clearly in such a terrible state that I was. And the anxiety just rising in me and that realisation that it was like, I'd reached the point where if you're trapped in an upper floor of a burning building, you're not going to jump out of the window straight away. You have to wait until the fear of the flames is greater than the fear of the fall. And I was in that moment there and I was like, which of these is going to be easier? And I can remember expecting them to tell me that I was lying or that I was delusional or that there was just something wrong with me or be horrified and just walk out. And they did none of those things. They were really nice and really supportive. And they said, oh, is that all? the social worker went, oh, is that all? And I was like, and it was just like a weight lifted off my chest. And then going, right, okay, well, now I'm going to have to come out and tell my family and my friends. And then coming out and not realising that I was gay for a long time. But a lot of that reasoning was like, well, you know, of course I don't find men physically, because men aren't, are they? Mm. No one thinks that. I was like, oh, no, actually quite a lot of people do. All right, okay. And it took a long time for me to go, oh, right, okay, yeah, no, I'm gay and trans. And at a time when there was so little information about people being trans out there, that even the idea that you could be both was so shocking. And like, what are you trying to prove, sort of thing. So coming out as gay for me was a lot easier. It was so interesting because I know a lot of people who are my age who came out as gay and had a lot of difficulty around that and came out as lesbian and struggled with things around that and struggled with shame associated with that. But because I'd never really had to think anything about that, I was just like, oh, I have absolutely no shame about this. This is absolutely not a thing that I need to feel any shame over whatsoever, because I'd saved all of that shame for being trans.
Yeah.
And it's that thing of realizing that the difference between embarrassment and shame is that embarrassment's where you feel like you've done something wrong, rather than that deep-seated feeling that you are in some fundamental way wrong.
The thing is that shame underpins almost every problem. I mean, you know, all our issues are all basically shame-based. Mm. And that's what trauma does to you. It causes shame about all sorts of things. And it's so easy to set up, as most parents know. We just, you know, it's really easy. An inadvertent word is all you need, a look. Nothing much.
Yeah.
And it builds on itself and it grows and it's an avalanche in the end. And then you end up doing whatever you can to avoid it.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm so happy now that the cartoon series Big Mouth exists. Because I honestly think that it is one of the most important television programmes I've ever seen, just in terms of dealing with this, dealing with these issues. And
a lot of sex education as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, as well as the shame aspect of it, yeah.
Yeah, because we don't tell people what's going on in our heads and we infer so much from what other people say or don't say or how they look at us.
Although I feel, I mean, just to quickly talk about Big Mouth, maybe we shouldn't do that, but like the shame monster guy?
The shame lizard.
The shame wizard.
Shame wizard. Shame wizard. Sorry, it's Coach Steve calls him Shane Lizard.
Yeah, exactly, that was too much for me. Like, I actually had to stop watching the program because it represented the whole, just shame. And it got it too good. And every time he came on screen, I felt so sad. I felt shame. I felt depressed. I was like, even though it's a cartoon, I was like, I can't do it anymore. Yeah. So it was too real. But that shows how good that show is. It's like,
if somebody, what you should be doing is thinking, if somebody's trying to shame me, what are they doing except trying to give you their shame?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all it's about. Because if you feel okay and you're not feeling any shame, why would you try and shame someone else?
Yeah, cool? Absolutely. Yeah. And if you think that somebody's shaming you, I've realised, or at least in my case, if I think that somebody's trying to make me feel shame and I'm not entirely sure, I should probably just eat something. most of the time.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You talked about how when you did come out as trans, that actually a lot of the fears that you had weren't realised.
Yeah.
That a lot of people were just like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Mm. And you were ready to fight and you were ready to be like, oh, you know, you were ready to have these conversations or even arguments with people and none of them ever happened.
Yeah.
I mean, was that a shock?
Yeah, it was. it absolutely was. I was absolutely prepared. I was absolutely prepared for every single worst case scenario.
Mm.
And to not have that, and to not only not have that, but have people be supportive was a really big shock to me. Mm. But even in spite of that, then going out into the world, I still have that fear around it. And it's one of those fears that won't go away. And I can remember when my therapist said, oh, so, you know, so how long have you had the agoraphobia? And I was like, I've not got agoraphobia. What are you talking about? I just don't like leaving the house. You know, I just prefer to be at home on my homebody. I'm not like, you know, Sigourney Weaver in Copycat who just stays at home and lives her life through the internet. Oh, fuck, no, I am, aren't I? Shit. And there's so much of that. And then I was ready for all sorts of fights that never happened. And then later the fights came. And it's that thing, because chatting through with my mum about my agoraphobia and her saying, well, you know, you've always been someone who's put yourself out there, who's never been scared, who's been always been able to get up on stage in front of a room full of people and say things, and you've fought battles and you've taken part in debates with people who don't even want you to exist. So how are you now in this situation where you feel like you can't get out of the house? And like, that's how I'm in that situation now. Mm. I fought too long and too hard for things that should have been mine anyway, in a way that just completely broke me down. And the worst of it, I think, more so than anything else, was a debate with someone who very much doesn't like my existence whatsoever. And I took part in this back when I thought you could still go and change people's minds by explaining things and telling them the truth.
Yeah.
They don't like that at all. It needs to feel true. It doesn't need to be true. That's the most important thing I've discovered. I've always called them gender deniers rather than anything else, because that's the position that they've taken. There were quite a lot of them there, and quite a lot of the celebrity ones who were in various different newspapers who were there. And it wasn't so much being around them or any of the things that they said or did. It was the sheer fact of me taking part in that meant that my own community sent me lots and lots of abuse for it.
Oh, no.
I got like loads of emails saying, oh, you've got blood on your hands. You're just going and you're giving these people legitimacy by discussing things with them, by being on a stage alongside them, that you have done this. And there were internet pylons and various other things. And I could always accept it when it was like one off. And what I'd never been used to was finding people who were ostensibly on my side deciding that what I was doing was so horrific that I was unforgivable for it. And that, alongside the regular fear that I'd had of being on the receiving end of transphobic attacks, and also because when I was growing up, and like I said, grew up in a little tiny village, And one of my friends when I was a kid came out as trans when she was in her teens and transitioned and ended up having to be homeschooled because she got attacked by various different kids. And it was just a horrible, horrible situation. And I'd seen her getting attacked, beaten up by kids on the bus and stuff, and just was so scared of doing anything to step in that I didn't, and just kept my head down. And one day it was the news had spread that she'd gone home to her mum's house and her mum hadn't let her in. And some of the kids who I'd been at school with who had picked on me and beaten me up had chased her, and she'd ended up trying to cross over a dual carriageway and had been hit by a car and died.
Oh, God.
And sitting there with that and thinking how differently our lives had gone and how I wished I could have defended her at some point and made it okay for her to be herself and hadn't. And the fear of being read as trans in public in that situation because of the things that have happened to me in the past and not being able to emotionally understand that the world has changed since then and I don't need to be. And so as a result of that, it's kind of always put me at a distance from the rest of the trans community, in spite of the fact that, like, you know, I'm the first trans person to be in a leading role on as a trans character on British television, you know. Really difficult pub quiz answer, for which almost everyone will say Rebecca Root. And to have that, and to the point that I really struggle with even watching shows which have trans characters in them, because the second that that's coming up, it's like, how is this going to be dealt with? Is this going to go and be triggering of all of these issues that I really struggle with on a day-to-day basis around that? And so I think that was, more than anything else, that was the thing which just sort of pushed me into feeling like I was trying to do something really, really good and try to do something helpful for my community, and it not working out, and not only not working out, but also me receiving a lot of anger and outpouring of hatred from people who I was, I don't want to say like should have been on my side, because that's not what it is at all, but it was a really, really difficult sort of period of my life, and it just left me in this situation where I was just like, I can't do any of this anymore.
But it's often the case, isn't it, that when people are trying to change things, they're very fixed in their views. And if you're a little bit further down the road, a little bit more mature, I suppose, then you can end up in real conflict with your, I was going to say tribe, but they who kind of stop being your tribe all of a sudden when you do something different.
Yeah.
It happens such a lot, and it's so, so traumatising.
Yeah, it is. And also now realising, like, because that must have been like 6 or 7 years ago that I did that, and now realising that because of the things that I've done and the way that I've lived my life out in public and openly and talked honestly about these things in an open and frank way as much as possible, that I've been a part of the world changing in terms of its acceptance of trans rights as it has become. So much so that there is an entire generation younger than me who is coming through and doesn't have any of these issues, have their own issues, obviously, but they don't have any of these specific ones that I have. And it's, on the one hand, I've said at multiple occasions that I'm really grateful of that, because I remember coming out and hanging out in the lesbian scene when I first realised I was gay, and spent a lot of time in the lesbian scene in Manchester and seeing older lesbians who were like a generation older than me, who all seemed to have this, like almost bitterness, about the younger, we fought so hard for these rights that you're enjoying that we don't get to have, and now you're just going about and being yourself. And recognising that that is the reward. That's your reward.
Yes, that's what, taking it for granted is what you fought for.
You planted a tree, the shade that you knew you wouldn't sit in, but, you know, you can enjoy watching other people sit in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's that thing of recognising your fading cultural relevance is a thing that so many people have a lot of difficulty with when they sort of hit their 40s, that they are no longer the young people who are about to change the way the world is, but they are the people who are now part of the establishment. And struggling with the fact that they then get called old-fashioned and out of touch, and that's your reward. So for me, one of the best moments that I've experienced in the last 18 months was when somebody on Twitter told me off for my language not quite being trans-inclusive enough.
Oh, I love it.
And when they said that, somebody pointed it out to them, that what they just said and who they just said that to. Mm. And they were like, oh my God. And I said, no, listen, do you know what? I am so grateful for this, because I have spent my entire adult life feeling like I'm fighting this battle on my own. Mm. And this lets me know that I can just put the baton down, because someone else is going to pick it up and run with it.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful moment. It was a fantastic moment to realise.
I usually like to end this podcast by asking our guests, how was it for you and was it good for you too? Is there anything you're taking away?
I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Excellent. Oh, thank you.
It was great. It was really nice. It was really enjoyable. Mm. And honestly, when I came into this, I didn't expect to nearly break down in tears in the middle of it, but I nearly did. And that's always a good way to spend an afternoon.
It really is.
Oh, dear.
Find your way to some emotional truth that makes you, that makes you comfortable.
Sorry.
No, this is such a lovely podcast to have taken part in. Thank you so much for asking me.
Oh, thank you. Oh, we've had a lovely time. It's been so great to meet you.
I mean, the fact that you've come on here and shared so much, for me, I always find it very healing when I share things, so I feel like that's a great advert.
It is. I know that I'm going to go away from this and go, got an hour of three therapy there. That's what I'm going to do. It was... gamed the system again.
Well, thank you so much again.
Absolutely.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
It's the mailbag. Send Kate your queries to podcast@hatch.com. It's the mailbag. Send Kate your queries podcast@hatch.com.
Hello there. I have a query for Kate. I would like to know when the real sex education mailbag starts.
The real sex education mailbag starts right now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Bethany Black for coming on. It was so great to speak to her. Now, Mum, it's time for some questions from our listeners. And to kick us off, we've got one from Ash, who says, Hi, Digree and Kate. Lately, my husband has been suggesting role-playing. I think it could be fun, but I'm worried because I'm self-conscious and terrible at acting. Do you have any tips?
Oh, that sounds really nice, actually. So role-play can be really good, fun when you're a bit anxious about sex, because when you're role playing, you can do whatever you want to do. You can be somebody different who is bold enough to do some of the things that you do, or you can be really timid and chaste and different. But it's a really good idea to work out a story beforehand. Now, some people think, oh, well, we'll have to just act out our fantasies. But anybody who's ever listened to this podcast before will know that if you do act out your fantasies, you can sometimes ruin them. And if they're your favourite, probably better to keep them to yourself. But a fantasy that you've developed between the two of you can be lots of fun. If there's any sort of kink involved, then you need to research that and use proper equipment and be very clear about safe words, and not safe words like stop, because sometimes that means go, and be very clear about what's going to happen and not deviate from that at all. Indeed, don't try to be innovative within the story. Do what you've agreed, otherwise it becomes non-consensual. But people have lots of fun using props and dressing up and with all sorts of silly stories. So, for instance, couple decided to do a story about somebody being pulled over by a policeman who said, I'm going to give you a ticket. And she said, oh, no, don't give me a ticket. I'll do anything. So they were doing anything. But he had come to the door in his police hat or some outfit, and a real police car was passing.
Oh, no.
And stopped and thought, oh, there's something kicking off there. I'll go and help.
Oh, no.
And knocked on the door. They didn't answer, but they were in the kitchen with the curtains open. And the police officer came round and looked through the window.
Oh.
And got a shock.
Peeping Bobby.
But they blamed me for that.
What?
Yes, because they said, oh, it was my idea that they should role play. So they had fun and a chat with the police officer.
A
new friend in an interesting way and then said, I'm never doing that again. But it can be terrific fun and you can be somebody that you can't be normally. So I would say just be really, really, really clear about the story and do make sure you've taken precautions like shutting the curtains.
I would also say, because this person said they're self-conscious and terrible at acting, I would say, you know, take it in baby steps. Things like the outfits, you know, that is something where, you know, it's a small thing you can do, but maybe just that alone will get you into the
mood.
Exactly. And can introduce you to the idea of role playing.
But you don't even need, I mean, you know, you don't necessarily have to have an outfit. And I think if Ash needs to remember, this isn't for anyone else. This is just for the two of you. So it should be great fun. And I don't suppose your partner's an amazing actor either. But it you know, it doesn't matter. It's how you feel and just the fun you have, really, isn't it?
P.S. My husband is Brad Pitt.
No, he's not. Yeah,
great actor.
No, he's great not. Actor.
Yeah.
Is Brad Pitt married to someone called Ash?
Our next question is from Shaz.
I knew it.
Who says, my wife has Asperger's and sometimes it's very difficult to talk to her about my needs. For instance, she does not like having her breasts touched. She has never liked this and gets really annoyed with me if I come anywhere near her chest. However, my breasts are really sensitive and she doesn't think to touch them either. I have tried talking to her about this and told her how much I enjoy touching and being touched, but she doesn't remember.
This is really difficult because people with autism or Asperger's sometimes have incredibly sensitive skin. And a lot of women don't like having their breasts touched. I mean, others love it, but there are some people who really, really hate it, are really turned off by it, and often have incredibly, incredibly sensitive skin, so that if you just stroke them, they get red marks and things like that. Wow. They're also often very sensitive to smell and bodily fluids and things like that, and don't like that kind of thing. So it can be quite difficult because they might like to stick to the same moves and really enjoy that. And it's a bit difficult if you want to be innovative. So maybe this is about, during sex, reminding your partner that you would like to have your breast touched, or maybe touch them yourself. And maybe that will give her the message. But I would take her hand or move her head if you want them licked or something like that, and perhaps tell her that you're going to do that in advance. If she really doesn't want to do it, of course, you will have to do it yourself, because if she's objecting, there's no way you can make her do it. But if she's quite keen, but just forgetting, that happens to a lot of people with Asperger's, and I wouldn't take it personally. I would just be innovative about ways to discuss it and remind her during sex.
Yeah, in the moment, just be like, it'd be really hot right now if you touched my boobs.
Yeah.
Boom.
Boom.
Excellent. Well, I think that about wraps up another episode of The Real Sex Education. Thank you so much again to Bethany Black for speaking to us earlier. Thank you to Kate Campbell for her accredited sex therapy wisdom. Thanks, Mum.
Thank you, Diggs.
And thank you for listening. See you next week for some more Real Sex Education. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Real Sex Education, which is hosted by Diggory Waite and Kate Campbell. The show is produced by Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Andy Goddard. The Real Sex Education is a Hattrick podcast. This podcast is based on the real-life relationship between Diggory Waite and his mother, accredited sex therapist Kate Campbell. The show is therefore inspired by, but otherwise unrelated to, the TV show Sex Education. But yes, Diggory does wish his mother was played by Gillian Anderson.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.